Literally, there were at least 2,456 fossil fuel lobbyists registered to attend. It's full of loopholes. I mean, this, to be honest, this is business as usual for the fossil fuel industry.
Listening to EU Watchdog Radio.
Hi, welcome. I'm Joanna Lausanne, Comms Officer at Corporate Europe Observatory, or CEO. In this episode of EU Watchdog Radio, I will talk to my colleague, Pasco Sabido, about what happened at the UN Climate Summit and what consequences it has.
Hi, Pasco.
Hey, Joanna.
So, COP28 just ended recently. What happened there?
Yeah, so COP28 in Dubai, in the UAE, there was a historic agreement, a historic outcome where they agreed to transition away from fossil fuels, the first time ever in what we're at now, COP28. So in 28 years, the first time ever such language has been used around fossil fuels. You know, the last two COPs, we had sort of phasing down coal or unabated coal, which is pretty like... yeah, narrow. And this is the first time all fossil fuels have been mentioned in a UN text like this. So it's pretty big. However, before cracking out the champagne, it's full of loopholes. I mean, this, to be honest, this is business as usual for the fossil fuel industry. Whilst, yeah, maybe we shouldn't have been, some people shouldn't have been so optimistic. I don't think I personally was very optimistic in the first place. This was being held with the president as the CEO of an oil company. The COP has been captured for many, many years by the fossil fuel industry. But what we see is that actually there's so many loopholes that it means the oil and gas industry can carry on increasing its production whilst claiming to be part of the solution. So it's actually really scary, particularly for, you know, those on the front lines of climate change, the communities who are already facing huge destruction. We're seeing the floods, the droughts, the fires, seeing islands literally being swallowed up by the sea, and this treaty is not gonna fix that, and it's also because it's not moving us away from fossil fuels, it means that all of those on the front lines of fossil fuel extraction are going to continue suffering, losing their lives and livelihoods. You know, the huge environmental pollution that comes from oil and gas drilling. I mean, it's a disaster. It's a model we need to move away from. And unfortunately, the COP28 outcome, what's called the UAE consensus, is not going to do that for us.
And does it at least have like specific dates by which we should be reducing CO2? Does it have specific targets that will lead to any meaningful change?
You would be so lucky. For CO2, I mean, look, it's previously said net zero by 2050, but net zero itself is a massive loophole, because ultimately what the net means is that you can carry on increasing emissions as long as somewhere they're decreased. So you get to the sort of balanced out of zero. But really, we need to be doing it now. Like, we need to have done it yesterday. That's the reality. When you've got the US, you know, across Europe, we're still approving new oil and gas licenses. So what we heard, I mean, it was amazing. Imagine, so after, you know, we transition away from fossil fuels, celebrated as a big win, celebrated by a big win by the oil and gas industry, which sort of should tell you enough about like how decent this deal is going to be for reducing oil and gas, if the oil and gas industry themselves are welcoming it. And as maybe like a really good example, so the climate change minister in the UK, a guy called Graham Stewart, he was asked like, how does this deal transitioning away from fossil fuels, has this intersect with like the UK approving more oil and gas licenses in the North Sea? And he said, oh no, they're part of transitioning away from fossil fuels. So drilling for more oil and gas is now transitioning away from fossil fuels. Like, this is 1984 doublespeak. So you can see just like how constraining this is going to be on new fossil fuel expansion at a time when, you know, the International Energy Agency has said two years ago already, that if we want to keep temperatures below 1.5 degrees, there's no more investments in fossil fuels, no more new exploitation, no more new projects of fossil fuels. And yet the US, the EU, Japan, other countries, those historical polluters, are going full steam ahead. I mean, it's sort of as, but this has been the problem of these talks for a long time. It's as if they exist in two different realities. So yeah, I think the lack of timeline, the lack of concrete targets, and also the lack of funding, because I think, like, of course, in Europe, in the US, we could massively reduce fossil fuel investments. We could really phase it out in a fair, just, and equitable way. But the reality is, in many countries, like if you look at sub-Saharan Africa, you still have what, 800 million people without access to electricity. And how are they going to move away? Like, they're still looking to develop their economies. Energy is, of course, a key part of that. How are they going to move away from fossil fuels if it's not being financed? So where's the money to do this? Where's the transfer technology for new renewables as well? I mean, yeah, we've seen a target for tripling renewable electricity by 2030 and doubling energy efficiency, but no money that's there, no money that's going to help countries do this. So instead, it's sort of like lumping them with more responsibility and no means to do so. And that is really important, this sort of what's called means of implementation, because this has been agreed under the UNFCCC from its very beginning, from its inception in 1992, that there's a common but differentiated responsibility between countries. So those who did the most and have the most capability to do something about it should be taking the lead. And they should also be helping those who have done the least to make that transition, to make that, allow them to leapfrog fossil fuels by transitioning to renewable electricity. And that's through providing money and providing technology, and it's just not materializing.
That's what is at the basis of climate justice as a
Yeah,
concept, of course. Yeah,
exactly.
if you see pictures from COP, from the people who were present, you see all the like frontline communities, indigenous communities doing small demonstrations, small protests, where like that was one of the demands. Indeed, that was mentioned. And is there a reason why these negotiations at COP are not going forward? I know like CEO is part of the Kick Big Polluters Out coalition, and throughout the years we have been doing research into the presence of fossil fuel lobbyists at COP. What was the discovery this year?
Yeah, so this year, I mean, I was actually not in Dubai, so let's just be very explicit. So it was a real honor to be able to provide something for those folks who were there, who are fighting the fossil industry on the ground, because our research showed there were almost four times as many fossil fuel lobbyists in Dubai as there were last year in Sharm el Sheikh in Egypt. I guess there's two reasons. One is because actually we had a massive victory in June this year, where we got the UNFCCC to demand every participant disclose who they worked for. So that means the fossil industry has to say, we work for the fossil industry. Of course, there'll be some loopholes, but it meant that we could see a lot more who was working for who, which is really great to see. And it allowed us to really expose how many there were. But the other reason there were so many, I mean, literally, there were 2,456, at least 2,456 fossil fuel lobbyists registered to attend Dubai. And it's because they're terrified. You know, they were really, really terrified. Their presence there was an indicator of just how seriously they were taking these talks, because their main goal was to rehabilitate their image, was to make sure they were no longer seen as the villains and they were now seen as part of the solution. So all of those lobbyists that were there, that was their main goal, you know, promoting. So one of the big things has been promoting that we reduce emissions rather than reducing fossil fuels, because of course their core product, their main money maker, is oil and gas, coal in some instances. So how do we stop talking about leaving oil and gas in the ground and start talking about reducing emissions from it? And that means, from the fossil fuel industry perspective, deploying new technologies like carbon capture and storage, which supposedly captures the emissions when you're burning fossil fuels, or hydrogen is the new silver bullet. Which is claimed to, like, can replace gas, it can replace oil, it can come from renewable electricity, but actually 99% of hydrogen today comes from fossil fuels. So, you know, the talks themselves, they agreed to transition away from fossil fuels, but there's a role for transition fuels. Transition fuels is industry speak for gas, unfortunately, for fossil gas. So that keeps them in business. It explicitly mentioned low carbon technologies like carbon capture, usage, and storage. So that keeps them in business. And maybe it's worth saying the usage bit of that, carbon capture usage and storage, they use it to pump it into oil fields to increase oil production. So this is the mad thing. 80% of CO2 captured through carbon capture and storage today, which is a tiny amount because the technology is useless and not profitable at all. But the tiny amount they do capture is pumped into oil fields. 80% of it is pumped into oil fields to increase fossil fuel production. So it keeps them in business in two ways. And then the text explicitly mentioned low carbon hydrogen, which means hydrogen being made from fossil fuels with carbon capture and storage. So that is all of these things are just, it's a, you know, this was Christmas come early for the fossil fuel industry, and they really got what they wanted. A lot of people, it was in Dubai, it was in the UAE. The COP president was, you know, the CEO of a national oil company, ADNOC. It's pretty shocking, like the mask is well and truly off in terms of who runs these talks. But let's not shy away from looking at our own governments, because in the EU, you know, we looked into the EU commission delegation and national governments, and they brought in more than 130 lobbyists on their delegations. You know, they gave badges to more than 130 fossil fuel lobbyists, including, you know, France brought in the CEO of TotalEnergies, Patrick Pouyanné. You saw, you know, Italy brought in, I think it was like 18 fossil fuel lobbyist teams from Eni, from the gas company Snam, from Enel, and the European Commission itself. I mean, this is mad. Not only did it bring in the CEO of Eni and the chief operating officer, it also brought in a lobbyist from ExxonMobil, like the big American oil and gas company. Why would the EU, the European Commission, be bringing in ExxonMobil, especially when ExxonMobil is currently suing the EU? It's suing it for introducing a windfall tax, because last year, when millions of us were suffering and struggling to pay our bills and put food on the table, ExxonMobil was making tens of billions in profit. And when the EU said, okay, we're going to introduce a tax to try and get some of that back, Exxon said, well, we're going to sue you. We're going to sue you for lost profits. And yet here it is, rolling out the red carpet to bring Exxon into COP28. So I think we need to like take a long, hard look at our own governments and their role in facilitating the fossil fuel industry.
But this is, I also thought it was really shocking when I look into that data from the report you just mentioned. But I'm like, does any country in the EU bring the same amount or more representatives from trade unions, from climate justice movements, as they do fossil fuel lobbyists? Is there given equal opportunity between the two fields?
Yeah, I mean, equal opportunity, I'm not sure, to be honest, who has the money to attend these things. And this is the problem. Like when we talk about we need to balance this out, actually you can't get balance, because it's just the wealth of the fossil fuel industry means they're much more able to attend. But we see, for example, this year, the fossil fuel industry brought seven times as many lobbyists as indigenous representatives from official indigenous delegations. You know, it had more lobbyists in Dubai than the delegations of the 10 most climate vulnerable nations combined. So these are the countries literally on the front line of climate change who need to be listened to, and yet they're being completely drowned out by the fossil fuel industry. And likewise, like trade unions, that the numbers were tiny. So when you look at what other interests are making it in, it's really tough. And my own experience at the COPs is lots of climate justice groups have been trying to come from those countries most impacted. They don't get visas. You know, the access to these talks is incredibly difficult unless you're well connected and working in the interests of, I guess, government of the fossil fuel industry. Then it's quite difficult to get into these talks.
And we've talked about Al Jabir being the president of COP, but we still haven't mentioned Wopke Hoekstra, who was leading on behalf of the European Union, the negotiations. So who is Hoekstra, Pascal?
Yeah, so Hoekstra is the new EU climate commissioner, replaced Frans Timmermans. And when he was nominated in October, there was a big scandal because he spent like more than a decade working for, well, he began his career at Shell and then spent more than a decade at McKinsey, the consultancy. And he's not told us who he worked for whilst there. despite pressure from MEPs. He's now come out and said he's not worked for the oil and gas industry or the fossil industry, but can't give any more info. But there's potentially like huge conflicts of interest. Who has he worked for? And he, you know, 5 years, he was also a partner there. So it's quite like, it's quite worrying that someone who is in a senior position at McKinsey is now heading up the EU's climate team, particularly like if you look at his climate record. So he went from McKinsey to become a Minister for Finance and then Minister for Foreign Affairs in the Dutch government in 2017. And whilst there, I mean, not only did he try and expand gas drilling in the north of the Netherlands, he also gave huge bailouts to KLM, the Dutch airline, and personally intervened to try and block tougher measures on nitrogen emissions. So his track record is appalling, but he was at COP, supposedly representing the EU. Like his own, yeah, I mean, it is interesting. I tried to look at what he was doing whilst in COP. Very, very keen on presenting himself as a climate hero, a climate champion. And in his last speech, in fact, the plenary, when, you know, when the transition away from fossil fuels was being announced and everyone was backpacking, patting themselves on the back, his speech was, you know, how he's standing with the friends of the EU and telling them we are here for you, particularly small island states. And that's mad because the EU blocked finance and blocked technology transfer to these very countries who need it the most. So whilst on the one hand saying we want to be a climate champion and we're going to stand by you, another, I mean, he's literally allowing them all to drown. Like the EU wants to present itself as a climate champion, but without providing that finance and technology, really what it's doing is just opening up new markets for its own companies. So who's going to be providing the hydrogen? Who's going to be providing the carbon capture and storage technology that's being touted in these agreements? These are going to be European companies. You know, this is part of the EU's big race to be a global leader in clean tech. And that's where a lot of the public subsidies in the EU are going. They're like financing it to the, yeah, through the roof. So maybe I'm being a bit too cynical, but I see without providing public finance and without providing that technology, the EU is really helping its own industries over those countries who need to transition and are most at risk of the impacts of climate change.
And what do you think that we can expect as a follow-up from COP? So now the next host country has been announced. It is Azerbaijan, and we will get to that in a bit. But between now and next COP, there will be an intermediary stage of negotiations. What can we expect from it there?
Yeah, so negotiators will come back together in June in Bonn, which happens every year, the sort of what are called the intersessionals. And that's actually a really important moment. That's when some of the rules are agreed of, you know, who gets to take part in these talks. And last year, well, sorry, this year even, we're still in 2023, aren't we? So in Bonn, we managed to, with the Kick Big Polluters Out campaign, we managed to win disclosure of like who works for who. But that was the first step. That has to be the first step on a much fuller, what's called an accountability framework. You know, we need a conflict of interest policy. We need to protect the UN process and decision making, also in Brussels, you know, also in national capitals. We need to protect decision making from the fossil industry. And so June in Bonn will be a really key moment for that. And we really want to ramp up that pressure, because in conversations with the Secretary General, with Simon Steele, he did say he's asked civil society to provide a roadmap, to sort of come forward with suggestions. And we have done so. So there are some concrete suggestions of how we can tackle conflicts of interest in Bonn. But there is the risk, you know, as everyone leaves COP28 and goes home, very few people pay attention to then what happens in Bonn. But the fossil industry does. And they are present. They were there this year. They've been there the year before. They will make sure they're there. So how do we make, you know, how do we keep up that pressure? Because if we don't, you know, if we don't capitalize on this anger, because there was a lot of anger at the influence of the fossil industry, but if we don't capitalize on this anger, then we're going to really be missing an opportunity to try and make these talks, yeah, I guess, fit for purpose. Because how many more COPs are we going to have that are in the interest of the fossil industry. So the goal, the goal is to kick them out. We've seen it happen to the tobacco lobby. Tobacco lobby got kicked out of the tobacco talks at the World Health Organization. And that's a great example that can be literally a North Star for all of us to how we can protect these talks from those very interests that have caused the problem we're trying to solve. So that's hopefully what's going to happen in June.
And then Azerbaijan. I mean, CEO has been doing a lot of research into it, the how repressive regimes try to interfere in European decision making. This is a little bit of a different side. But what do you think can be expected from it? And what consequences can it have, the fact that it will be held in Azerbaijan?
Yeah, I think that's really important to say, because so it's worth like zooming out a bit. It's not just that Azerbaijan is also an oil and gas producer. It's worth highlighting for who, you know, since, I guess since Russia's initial annexation of Crimea, there was a big shift in the EU to move away from Russian oil and gas, Russian gas in particular. So who did the EU turn to? Turned to Azerbaijan, built a massive new pipeline called the Southern Gas Corridor, you know, dripping in human rights abuses. How many political prisoners have been locked up in Azerbaijan and along the entire pipeline in order to make this thing happen? And they've completely whitewashed the regime there. I mean, it's an incredibly repressive regime, and it's been whitewashed because the EU needs gas. So we've seen the Azerbaijani lobby really active in Europe, not just around gas, but around culture, around economic development and partnerships to try and normalize that relationship. So we have to realize that when it's happening in Azerbaijan, it's happening, you know, in a country that the EU has a really good relationship with and doesn't want to criticize because it needs gas, particularly since the full-scale ground invasion last year. The EU has turned to Azerbaijan again and said, can you increase the amount of gas you're putting through this pipeline? So, you know, the hypocrisy is massive. Let's go from one repressive regime to another. But it means that Azerbaijan will have the political cover of the EU. So I think it's a really tricky one. I mean, to be honest, we saw the same in the UAE. The EU and member states are doing gas deals with the UAE. They're doing hydrogen deals with the UAE. And the same is going to happen in Azerbaijan. So I think it's going to reinforce the fossil fuel industry and the fossil fuel economy rather than transitioning us away, which is highly depressing. But the problem is less where it's being held. Of course, that's a real big part of the mood music. But the problem is, you know, what's happening in our national capitals? What positions are governments coming to the talks with? Are they prepared to really deliver climate justice? Or are they going to protect the fossil fuel industry, whether it's in Azerbaijan or in Brazil, which is where COP30 is going to be? You know, I think, of course, it's going to make a difference. But let's take a step back and realize these COPs are always a symptom of the geopolitics happening in the world at the time. So when you've got a sort of a US government who's now become, you know, the US is now the biggest oil and gas producer and exporter, like bigger than Saudi Arabia, bigger than everyone else, that's where their interests lie. So, and they're one of the most influential players at the talks. Likewise, the EU is looking to export loads of green tech. So what's it going to be pushing? So yeah, I think it being in Azerbaijan is problematic, but we need to look at the governments and the positions they're arriving with before they even get to Baku in Azerbaijan.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
We have come to the end of this podcast. If you liked it and you appreciate the work of CEO, please help us stay independent. Sign in to our newsletter at corporateeurope.org and follow us on social media. Till next time, bye-bye.